Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Well, here we are, Larry, recording live from FYP Studios East and West. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 223 of Registry Matters. How are you, sir?
Awesome. Good evening. How has your day been? I understand it's been very different from a normal Saturday.
It has been a very special day. Do you know what a tough mudder is? Have you ever heard this term?
No, I have not.
This is complete insanity. And the final thing. So my friend says, hey, man, you want to do a tough mudder? I'm like, oh, my God. Why would you sign up to do some kind of race with obstacles and a lot of mud? But he's a good friend. Sports the podcast, super good friend. So I was like, sure. And he goes, but we're going to do the 15K. And I don't want to do a 15K, but whatever. 15K is like 9 and change miles. How bad can it be? 9 and change miles and 30 obstacles, Larry. So I will describe to you the final obstacle. This will just color the whole thing perfectly. You are already exhausted after moving for 4 hours. And they have these like string things hanging down, and they are electrically charged. And these don't tickle you, Larry. These punch you. And I got like just into the water. And oh, by the way, you're in water and then you have electricity on you. And the first one hit me. I felt like I'd gotten punched. And then I like kind of like buckled down. And the next one hit me in my ear. And I was like, you know what? I'm done. And that's where I tapped out of that particular obstacle. And I was done, but 4 hours and 33,000 steps.
Wow. So you did tap out.
I didn't tap out. I just did not do that obstacle, so to speak. I mean, I started it. There was a lot of cold water. There were a lot of over the tops, and there was a lot of climbing through mud, and it was pretty diabolical.
So
that's how my day was.
Well, that was awesome.
Definitely awesome. Well, I guess then we'll dive in. And let's do the quick news piece first. So I'll run this one first. Hey, Larry, did you know that...
You come back and call Vegas.
Hey, that's the wrong one. Did you know that I had some big news personally this week?
You did have some amazing news. Let's hear your news first. That would take the priority over all news.
I'll just cut to the chase. I was at lunch yesterday. And I got a phone call from the local sheriff's office, and he said that the GBI has removed me from their website. And so I'm off the register.
Awesome. I've heard some chatter about it. I think there's been more than a dozen congratulatory comments to you. And that certainly proves that a process, however flawed it may be, is preferable to having no process at all. Would you agree with that?
I think I would agree with that for sure. Whether it's slow, whether it's narrowly tailored, at least there was an option. Georgia wasn't that bad in the grand scheme of things. But that's the deal. So I am no longer, I went and looked my name up on the Georgia website and somebody else's name showed up, not mine.
Yeah, I saw a screenshot of that. It's awesome.
I am pleased. And all right, so then I will, so there's enough of that. Yay, cheers for me. Woo! All right, and then the next breaking news. And this one will be, the breaking news comes from WOLO in Columbia, South Carolina. In a settlement agreement with South Carolina Attorney General Alan Wilson, along with State Law Enforcement Division Division Chief Mark Keel, those wrongly convicted of... I got to find the right buttons earlier. Mark Keel, those wrongly convicted of sodomy in the state of South Carolina, will now be taken off the PFR registry in the Palmetto State. The settlement was reached after arguments had taken place before the court. The challenges argued based on a 2003 ruling from the United States Supreme Court in the case of Lawrence versus Texas that anti-sodomy laws were no longer deemed constitutional. According to Alan Chaney, the director of legal advocacy for the American Civil Liberties Union, over the past two decades, South Carolina has used the PFR registry to track, shame, and ostracize people who he argued have been involved in behavior protected by the Constitution and acts that are between consenting adults. Cheney adding in a statement released to ABC Columbia News, "I am pleased that the state agreed to settle the case, but discouraged that we had to sue at all. The ACLU says the move brings justice to men that have long been wrongfully classified as PFRs, and as of the settlement, will have their cases filed under seal to protect their identities and privacy. Those who have worked to modify the law say those who have been affected will be able to have their rights restored and tarnished records restored. Within 21 days of this new order, South Carolina Law Enforcement Division will have to notify those solely convicted of buggery under South Carolina Code 19-15-120 in writing to let them know they will no longer have to register as PFR offenders in the state of South Carolina. Kudos to those who have their name removed from the PFR list. Since this is a stipulated settlement, Larry, will the ACLU receive attorney's fees in this case as prevailing party under the provision of 42 U.S. Code Section 1983? I've heard of this one before.
They absolutely will indeed. Actually, in paragraph 8, it states that defendants shall pay plaintiff's attorney's fees a total of $31,592.30 for full resolution of plaintiff's fees, costs, and expenses in this action.
Doesn't sound like that much money, Larry.
Well, it's not that much. It's covering their cost for their time. So they're going to be made whole for having to bring this action.
Okay. And so this was the ACLU's cost associated with the filing and the work in advance of a potential trial. I can only imagine how much, work would be in a case where a full trial had been necessary. If it had gone to a full trial, how much, like, they would have had a monster amount of work.
Yeah, this was relatively a straightforward issue where expert testimony would not have been necessary. The question was really whether or not South Carolina could impose the consequences of PFR registration on those who had engaged in constitutionally protected conduct as adults. It was really a matter of determining if the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Lawrence versus Texas is binding in the state of South Carolina.
And this kind of lawsuit does kind of confuse me, though. I agree with the ACLU, and I'm not understanding why a lawsuit had to be filed. Could you people explain that to me, please?
Sure, but you're not going to like the explanation because it's political. So are you going to let me answer with an answer you don't like?
That'll be fine. Go ahead.
The reason is that the registration law, as is all other laws of the state, are presumed to be constitutional. So this was one of the enumerated offenses. So if the Attorney General of South Carolina had decided to unilaterally declare that anyone convicted of sodomy would not have to register, that AG would have been vilified. He or she would have been accused of all sorts of malfeasance. Just think back not that many years ago when the Obama administration decided not to appeal favorable rulings from lower courts declaring that same-sex marriage ban was unconstitutional. The conservatives went ballistic, and they claimed he was unilaterally making law himself. That would have been a political risk to the Attorney General of South Carolina. This lawsuit provides the political cover for letting people off the PFR list. The AG now says, you know, the court was ultimately going to order it, and so I just went ahead and stipulated.
All right. Well, then, based on the stipulation, it appears that the state is required to remove all persons described in paragraph 2 and 3 above as expeditiously as possible and in no event later than 21 days from the date of entry of this order. Do you, like, I mean, isn't this similar to Michigan? Like, we're going to remove everybody from the registry, but no, they don't really do it. Do you think that they will do this one?
I think the odds are a lot greater because in Michigan, they had lost a case that they were trying to figure out a way to overturn. But in this one, they've entered in what's called a stipulation. And the Attorney General can bind the state of South Carolina. So this one, they're risking being held in contempt if they don't do it. So I think there's a really good odds that they'll do it.
And on top of that, Larry, they are required within 90 days of entry of this order to provide notification to the sheriff's office of the individual's county of residence for all persons described have been removed from the South Carolina PFR list and is no longer subject to the requirements of the South Carolina Sex Offender Registry Law. What would happen if a person who should have been removed by this stipulation is arrested subsequently? Like, but arrested for what? Arrested for some sort of PFR crime or in general?
Right, like if they didn't take them off the list. If the sheriff somehow lost the transmission and did not take them off of their local list, and they went out and arrested them for not doing their 90-day or their annual. That's what this is about.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, let's hope it doesn't happen. But if it did, it certainly would not be good, because the state having entered into a stipulation, there's no question that they're obligated to do it. So the person would likely have a very good cause of action and the potential for monetary damages as well.
Well, okay. So that is pretty awesome news that all of those, do you have any idea how many people that might impact?
I didn't get any feedback from our South Carolina people about how many. I suspect it's a very narrow universe, but if it saves a dozen, if it saves whatever, it's very important to them, but I suspect it's a relatively small number of people.
Let me ask you another question. I swear I remember you and I having a conversation, and you've said something to the effect of, those are not enforced anymore, those aren't on the books anymore, blah, blah, blah. So these would be, I'm assuming these would be reasonably old cases?
Yes, these would be old cases. Now, I can't say that for sure, but I'm presuming that once Lawrence versus Texas was decided, that every charge of what they call it, buggery in South Carolina, I would imagine the first motion a defense attorney would have filed, if he or she were reasonably competent, would be that this is an unconstitutional statute. So I'm prefacing it by saying I would suspect that these would be pre-Lawrence convictions for people. But this would be one of those things where textualism would not be so good, because you would look at the law and you would say, well, this is an enumerated crime, is it not? Yes. Well, you were convicted of it, were you not? Yes.
Right.
Well, it seems to me that this statute covers you. And that's the position the state would have been taking up until now.
That word buggery is funny. If you ever watch any British television, they use the word bugger a lot. And bugger means what they're describing here for these people in this individual kind of crime. It means a dude-on-dude intercourse. Can I say it that way? Is that fair?
You just cost us to be kicked out of 150 prisons.
Well, the transcription person, as you're hearing this, take that out. All right, well, then let's move on, Larry. The next issue is the law that you people put in from the state of Florida, with an emphasis on the duh part, statute that has a section pertaining to the prosecution of sex dolls. Oh, I remember this coming out not terribly long ago. What is this all about again?
Well, it came up in discussion yesterday on the National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys listserv, and it's Florida Statute 847.011, subsection 5B1, and it reads as follows. Except as provided in subparagraph 2, a person who knowingly has in his or her possession, custody or control, an obscene child-like sex doll commits a misdemeanor of the first degree. What is a child-like doll?
I would have to tell you, man, I have no, how do you identify? Do you know what the most popular costume for adult play is? It's like the schoolgirl, a plaid skirt. And I'm not trying to promote anything, I'm not trying to say anything, but that is the most popular costume is that outfit. So how does that make how do you then make a doll look childlike?
Well,
pigtails.
I have no idea. The statute doesn't define it.
All right. Well, then, okay. I brought you people. Oh, have always claimed that statutes have been crafted in such a way as to provide a person of ordinary intelligence with specificity so he or she can conform their behavior to the requirements of the law. Is this statute not void for vagueness?
Well, that is in fact what the person's attorney believes. He said the doll in evidence is a sex doll with silicone orifices. It was shipped from China and marketed on the packaging written in Mandarin as a Japanese student. I'm only reading, folks.
Okay.
I was wondering, he says, if other states have passed similar laws and whether anyone has challenged this kind of statute under void for vagueness or First Amendment grounds or any other constitutional challenge. The attorney said, it seems to me that, quote, child law, as opposed to merely child, could make the statute more vulnerable to attack. The analogy with pornography would be an adult model dressing childlike, which may be legally protected by the First Amendment, as opposed to the depiction of an actual child, which has no protection of the First Amendment. And I can see where he's going with that in terms of,
totally.
Yeah, so that's, therein lies the problem.
It seems that to me that the void for vagueness challenge would be appropriate in the absence of a statutory definition. My recollection of your rants is that the words of common usage are to be construed according to their plain and ordinary meaning, which can be ascertained by reference to a dictionary. Whether the statute gives reasonable notice to the conduct it prohibits is, I guess, a question. A sex doll depicting an 18-year-old student is legal, but one depicting a 17-year-old student is not. What would you do here?
Well, I haven't had enough time to thoroughly, since this just was posted yesterday, to cogitate on this. So I'm going to plagiarize what an attorney wrote in response. The attorney says, there is no one accepted definition for childlike. Merriam-Webster defines it as impressionable, inexperienced, malleable, wide-eyed, artless, genuine, and about 25 other synonyms. One of the definitions in the Britannica Dictionary is having or showing the pleasing qualities such as innocence that children often have. The Cambridge Dictionary defines the word as showing good qualities that children have, such as trusting people, being honest, enthusiastic. I don't think a doll can do any of those foregoing things, do you?
No, and if anybody here has children, they are not honest often. Larry, when you were a child, did you always tell the truth 100% of the time?
Absolutely not.
I think that if I asked the legislator who passed this absurd law, would they say that they meant young? But there are 80-year-olds who have childlike qualities, a 12-year-old who do not. The word does not give any sufficient notice of what they are supposed to be doing. The failure to define sex doll only compounds the problem. Some people are turned on by Barbies. Does this make them sex dolls? This could be very, this can't be constitutional.
Well, I would point out that any limitations on First Amendment rights have to be justified by compelling state interest. What is the state interest here? Ending the exploitation of dolls? How is any child made safer by this law?
And to take a quick little detour, Larry, if someone was legit attracted to the young people, wouldn't this be a way for them to have an out instead of acting out in real life? And when did the thought crimes become crimes?
Well, therein is another
when did good, thoughts become crimes?
A good point. That's what I've been ranting about for a long number of years. You can think about wishing that you had all the money that's in the vault. That's not against the law to fantasize about having it. It's against the law when you begin to plan and execute to remove that money from the vault and put it into your possession.
Well, okay, well, let's get out of here and move on to the case from Washington. Do you want to talk about Washington versus Washington for a moment first?
Well, I was having fun with it last week, but the person didn't think it was as funny as I did because I hear it so often, and apparently in Washington, they don't hear it very often, but I hear it. I've heard it for decades.
And so this Washington Supreme Court case is State of Washington versus Douglas Arbogast. Police officers posted an advertisement online and posted a mother seeking a person to teach her two children about sex. Arbogast answered the ad, exchanged messages with undercover officers, and was later arrested. At trial, Arbogast sought to present the affirmative defense of entrapment and his lack of criminal convictions as evidence that he was not predisposed to commit the charged crimes of attempted child rape. The trial court denied the jury instruction. Why?
Well, that is a good question. At the conclusion of the case, the state argued an entrapment instruction was not justified because Arbogast failed to show government inducement and lack of predisposition by preponderance of the evidence, meaning that he was supposed to show that he had a burden to prove. And the court agreed, concluding that there was some evidence to support such luring, but none, not more than normal. The court therefore denied the entrapment instruction and precluded any evidence showing the absence of criminal record to show lack of predisposition, and that's on page 7 of the opinion. It was the state's position that Arbogast was predisposed to have sex with a child because of the chat logs with the detective, which I did a glance through them, and I didn't read it the same way. Now, the title of the ad suggests that, but as I read through a quick gander at the chat log, I didn't pick up on it. It seemed like to me just opposite. He was trying to hit on the mom is what it seemed like to me.
I'm confused because according to the court, in 1975, state lawmakers codified entrapment in statute, providing that in any prosecution for a crime, it is a defense that the criminal design originated in the mind of law enforcement officials or any person acting under their direction. Okay, and then the actor was lured or induced to a crime, to commit a crime which the actor had not otherwise intended to commit. Did they not induce Arbogast?
Well, that's a bit dicey in this case. The defense of entrapment is not established by showing only that law enforcement officials merely afforded the actor an opportunity to commit a crime. And that's where people get confused. They say, well, you know, they should have told me. Well, no, they didn't have to tell you that they were the police. But your point is, did they induce him? I'm thinking that they very well came close to doing that in this particular case. So therein lies the reason for the appeal.
And in Washington, defendants must prove entrapment by a preponderance of the evidence. Remind me, preponderance, is that more than 50?
Slightly more than 50.
Okay. Other jurisdictions, including under federal law, shift the burden from the defendant to the government and require disproving entrapment beyond a reasonable doubt. I've heard you rant over and over about burden shifting. Isn't this burden shifting, and isn't it similar to what was required in Arizona? It's the May case all over again?
Well, it very close is to the May case all over again, the burden shifting. And yes, you've actually heard me rant about burden shifting. Every aspect of charging is presumed that you're innocent and you have no duty to say a word, to raise a defense. The government has to carry the burden, and your silence by refusing to do something should get you nowhere. But anyway, the court stated, we considered and rejected this approach in Lively, that was the name of a case that they were relying on, reasoning that Washington has long required defendants to prove affirmative defenses by the preponderance standard because these defenses are uniquely within the defendant's knowledge and ability to establish. For example, an affirmative defense is self-defense. When you say, yes, I did kill the SOB, but my throat was about to be slashed if I didn't pull the trigger. So you have affirmed the state's accusation that it was you who pulled the trigger, but under the circumstances, you should be not responsible. So they applied that standard here that you have to acknowledge the crime. So they're saying this is merely another affirmative defense. Therefore, for you to utilize it, you have to acknowledge that you were soliciting these for to have a hookup with these children. Anyway, they go on to say, we saw no reason to distinguish entrapment from other defenses and thus no reason to shift the burden from the defendant to the state, other than the fact the Constitution requires it. Thus, defendants are ultimately responsible for proving they were improperly induced to commit a crime they otherwise would not have committed. Now they've changed that in this case. They've actually established a new precedent regarding entrapment in the Arbogast case. So this is big news.
They stated the failure to instruct on entrapment was far from trivial or merely academic here. It precluded Arbogast from contextualizing the evidence with the law and prevented him from presenting the defense he wished. As we have discussed, a reasonable juror could have concluded that Arbogast was entrapped. Thus, the trial court's refusal to allow an entrapment defense or to admit evidence that Arbogast had no criminal history or inappropriate involvement with children was not harmless. I think Arbogast had already served prison sentence, so what did the order serve as remedy?
Well, I'm a little confused, and we're going to have a brilliant guest next week that's going to, if you want to go ahead and tease that guest, we're going to have someone who's been on before that has some relationship to this issue. But maybe we can get more enlightenment from her. But the court affirmed the Court of Appeals, which is the mid-level appeal, and the Court of Appeals had said to the trial judge, you got it wrong. But I'm not sure what that ultimately will mean, because I think he's served his time, at least his prison sentence. That would possibly put him back in a pre-convicted posture, which would give the state an opportunity to do the trial or dismiss the charges. But anyway, the conclusion reads, entrapment, like any other affirmative defenses in Washington, requires defendants to present some evidence supporting the elements of the defense to justify a jury instruction. Here, Arbogast made a prima facie showing of entrapment pursuant to statute, blah, 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 that the crime originated with the Washington State Patrol and that Arbogast was induced to commit the crime of attempted child rape. which he otherwise lacked the predisposition to commit, evidence of which lack of criminal history was admissible under the law, the trial court erred in determining and declining to provide the requested entrapment instruction, and thus the error was not harmless. We therefore affirm the Court of Appeals, which means that this case is finished. There's nowhere else for them to go in Washington. But what happens next? Does he get a new trial? Do they dismiss the charges? I don't know.
It is noteworthy an amicus brief was filed by the Washington Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, urging that they affirm the case, affirming the Court of Appeals. Was Narsal involved in this?
We were not, because we didn't know about it until now.
But I thought you guys had tentacles in all corners of the United States.
Well, now you are correct. We do have a very elaborate research and writing staff out there that consisting of dozens of paralegals and probably at least a half dozen staff attorneys, but we missed this one.
So we are speaking around the margins about being in jest, though, but the Supreme Court of South Carolina case, like, showed up on everyone's doorstep, like, hey, how come Narsal doesn't know about them, and how come people don't reach out to advocacy groups to see if there isn't someone that could help them?
Well, they reached out to the Defense Lawyers Association. There's just not enough knowledge of our existence. The organizations and the advocacy is very small still, and people don't know about us. That's one reason they don't reach out to us. And then they've got this jerk that's a gatekeeper of their legal project that's so tough on everything. But this is one that gatekeeper would have been very interested in. But he's just such a tyrant when it comes to accepting cases. It's very hard to get past him.
Okay. We're going to take a quick little detour. Narsal's been around for like 12 years?
Longer.
Larry?
Longer.
Longer. Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't hear you say longer. Why don't the million PFRs know about us? Them? We?
Well, I think that a lot of the PFRs do know about us, but the question would be, the attorneys would have to know. They would have to know what our resources are. And that was part of what we tried to achieve by attending these exhibits, like at the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, letting them know that we exist. They have a limited amount of funding available to help with constitutional challenges, and that's one of the reasons. But the knowledge just is out there. If you do a Google search, you're going to come up with Narsal. But when you're trying to prepare litigation of this, you're thinking of ACLU. I mean, that's the first thing that comes to your mind.
Yeah, sure.
And the ACLU says no on almost everything, although they did not say no on the case that we just discussed at the beginning of the episode.
Gotcha. Okay. Anything on that one? Anything else before we move on to the next pieces?
Well, since I mentioned the ACLU, that was an example of a case where when people say, how do they screen their cases? That one was one where they had almost a certainty of victory because the U.S. Supreme Court and Lawrence had already said that sodomy between consenting adults is any prohibition is unconstitutional. So therefore, it stands to reason you would flow from that you couldn't force a person to have a lifetime collateral consequence for a conviction that was unconstitutionally obtained. So that one was going to be an easy one. So therefore, they looked at that and said, our odds of successfully resolving this issue, those odds are fairly good. And that's the type of case that they like to take. And every organization likes to take those type of cases because they're expensive to go through. This one did not take nearly as long because it was relatively straightforward. If you look at the document on the stipulation, I think it's like document number 2526. Normally, those cases would have well over 100, sometimes multiple hundreds of pleadings. Each time there's something filed in the case, it goes up by one number. And this was a relatively brief case from beginning to end on the first one from South Carolina.
Okay. Well, then to move along, Larry, there's a statement that you put in here from NACDL. Shall I read this?
Sure. Let's go put it in, give it some context. What are you people reading about?
Well, I guess I'll just read and hopefully that will become clear from there. It says, NACDL President Martin Sabelli issued the following statement in response to the Supreme Court's failure to hear the case of Christopher Love versus Texas. On Monday, the Supreme Court refused to hear the case of Christopher Love, a black man convicted and sentenced to death in Texas by the vote of a juror who believes that non-white races are statistically more violent than whites. Oh, this is awesome. 6 of 9 justices did not find that this expression of racial hatred sufficiently undermined the integrity of the verdict to merit their review. This human and social tragedy, and others like it, will continue to divide our nation until and unless we demand real diversity at every level in our state and federal courts, a diverse judiciary with lived experience mirroring our communities would and will appreciate the profound injustice of allowing a racially prejudiced juror to judge another. A house divided cannot stand, and divided we are if our courts, despite the Bill of Rights, equal protection, and common decency, empower the naked racial prejudice of a juror whose authority derives from the court who administered the oath to him. Holy crap! Seriously?
Powerful.
My God, he believes that non-white races are statistically more violent than whites? That's abhorrent.
Well, but what's more important is that that did not merit scrutiny by the highest tribunal in the country. That's what's even more frightening. But this is a powerful statement by the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
Good grief, man. And could you provide any insight as to why they would have not granted, and this would be granted cert, yes?
Yes, but well, I mean, I don't have that insight other than the fact that they're just not interested in reviewing death cases. They are not. They have not
even
been
as egregious as this would be.
It doesn't matter. They are not interested. They've conveyed that over and over numerous times about the potions that are being used. They said, well, you're not entitled to a painless death. I mean, they're just not interested in reviewing the death penalty. Scalia, we don't have that clip queued up. But since the death penalty is not unconstitutional, according to the majority on the Supreme Court, the only way you will stop this is you'll have to change the statute, which we've done in our state. We don't have a death penalty anymore. But quit whining to the courts, because the federal courts are not predisposed to give you any relief on the death penalty.
Are you referring to the constitutional but stupid?
No, I'm referring to where he's actually said that the death penalty is not unconstitutional. There was no intention to preclude the imposition of the death penalty. If you don't like it, change it by statute. But he says it's not unconstitutional. The Constitution prevents the deprivation of life, liberty, or property without due process. Theoretically, the converse would be, if you've had due process of law, they can deprive you of life, liberty, and property.
I understand, but wouldn't a comment like that, damn it, wrong button again. Wouldn't that comment that non-white races are statistically more violent than whites, wouldn't that garner some kind of, I don't have the word to, wouldn't that call the trial into question that this person would have found anybody guilty of this just because he dislikes blacks that much?
Well, he's one of 12, but that's not the point. This court has no interest in the death penalty.
Jesus. I understand what you're saying, but like, it seems like at some point in time, something would cross over that threshold. And this seems like that would be one of those things.
Not with this court. Not. It's not going to. They have rejected. There used to be a time when the individual justice was granted a stay of execution. They have dissolved every one of those stays. And that's what they're likely to do if the, I don't know which justice oversees the Fifth Circuit, which is the case we talked about last week. But if such a stay were to be granted, if it happened to be one of the three liberal justices, the full court would dissolve that stay almost immediately. So it's just not, I mean, you're barking up the wrong tree with this Supreme Court.
Wow. I swear, I think you told me earlier this week, Larry, that it's Thomas that's over the Fifth Circuit. We were talking about
I didn't
the,
look it up. I said it'd be woman. Funny. It'd be funny if it was. But
I misunderstood. Okay.
Yeah. So yeah, whichever justice.
Holy macaroni. That's terrible, Larry. Okay. Wow. All right. Hey, good on us for making the Supreme Court that we have, right? Good on us.
Well, that's a whole different debate. Whether the Supreme Court should save us from ourselves. Scalia says no. If you don't like the death penalty, repeal it.
I agree, but we are the ones that have made the Supreme Court by proxy of the different presidents that we have elected over time that give us the Supreme Court justices we have.
Well, I don't think that people would have been thinking about that all through eternity when they voted for president, that Supreme Court. Well, this, I mean, the average person wouldn't have thought about that till very recently.
Very true. All right, and so let's move on. And this one came in, I think, just like an hour or two, maybe a couple hours ago. It says, and this is from an email comment. It says, again, Larry, you said, because as I read through the complaint, one of them has a service dog, or maybe a couple of them have service dog for a companion support. Well, that just barred them from shelters, because the shelter's already compact enough and cramped enough. Space is at a premium, so they just can't let people have their companion animals. So they have exempted themselves. Now, are you willing to state that you are wrong about something sometimes?
Well, no, because I was reading from the complaint. And I would encourage this person to actually read the complaint. And I'm going to read that paragraph. So plaintiff number one was named Fitzpatrick. And paragraph 20 of the complaint says Fitzpatrick is not able to stay at the local homeless shelters even when beds are available because of his mental health conditions and because he has an emotional support dog that is not welcome there. So this is what Fitzpatrick's attorney alleged and stated to the court to be a true fact. This is not what Larry said. What Larry said was that the shelters are compact and cramped, and I stand by that. I'm guessing this person may or maybe they haven't stayed in a shelter. I have. And they're stacked up like cordwood in bunks. They're very, very uncomfortable. And they are running a shelter for humans. They're not running an animal shelter. And I probably misspoke because it said emotional support dog. It didn't say a service animal. I don't know anything about the laws in that state about what dogs are allowed and what dogs are not allowed. I only know this. If it's cold and the wind is howling and you have to make a choice, I'm telling you the choice I would make. If I wanted to be warm and be fed and to have some degree of safety from people out on the outside that could do any number of harmful things to me, I would choose myself over the dog. Now, that's just my choice. But what really troubles me is that we are for this case. That was abundantly clear. We're hoping this case helps us. The person who would hear this and think that somehow or another that we are not sympathetic, I pontificate more than anyone about our lack of services for the homeless and for the people who can't make it in our economy. And so someone's very unhappy that has to focus on something like that and just try to find I got you moment here. Really?
Yeah, I don't know what else to say about that, Larry.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
So we will just move along then to a voicemail that we received from one of our patrons, and I will try to press the right button. So I have this automatic scene switcher thing, and I forgot to install it on my new computer, so I'm having to manually press things. And when I go to the other screen, I end up with all the voice clips. So, but anyway, so here's a voicemail from my patron.
Hey, Annie and Larry, this is a follow-up about my cousin who was arrested by the FBI. I know I've sent in several, requests at this point, but I'm wondering if, we're wondering, is there, any chance at all that he'll get probation? I mean, I know you talked about it a few months ago, but it just seems so unfair to me, that there's no chance at all he'll get probation. Speaking of that, has anything changed? We keep hearing about criminal justice reform, and will that, possibly trickle down to him getting probation? Thank you, and FYP.
I take it that is see, I did it again. That I take it that that is your opinion of what will happen and him getting probation.
Well, now that's a little tongue in cheek here now, because I know the person who's sending in this question, but for a person to pose a question like that, I would wonder if they're actually watching and paying any attention to the news. And after a week of confirmation hearings with lenient sentencing and downward departures for child porn possession, and in every one of those downward departures, no one got directly remitted to probation, to my recollection. They were always sentenced to a period of imprisonment, although shorter than what the guidelines recommended. For a person to think that in this political environment right now, with every judge potentially under scrutiny, that they're going to be able to give a probated sentence for a case, which that one is fairly significant in terms of the allegations that have been put forth by the federal, by the feds. I mean, that is somewhat out of touch with reality to think that.
Okay. Yeah. We have talked about most of the judges are elected.
Not in the federal system. They're appointed for life.
Right. But at the state level.
Okay, well, this is in the federal system.
Oh, okay. So then they don't necessarily have to do a whole lot of political cover for themselves in a case like this. They're not a Judge Persky is what I'm really trying to say.
Correct. But what they do have to do now, after what was done to, what's her name, Ketanji Brown Jackson.
Okay, Ketanji Brown Jackson.
What they have to do now is that if they have any ambition, any trial judge who has any ambition whatsoever to be appointed to the United States Court of Appeals for one of the appellate circuits, or if they harbor desires to serve on the U.S. Supreme Court, can you imagine what they would do now going forward after all this brouhaha? Do you think they would say, yeah, let me see if I can keep departing from the guidelines going down. I know that's going to help me get an appointment to the Court of Appeals. So the type of judge that would do that would be a judge like, remember Judge Mach up in Colorado that was like appointed by President Nixon, and he was still a trial judge, and he's now deceased. But he did the case that ultimately was overturned by the Tenth Circuit. Someone like that who is quite up in years and harbor no ambitions to be anything other than what they are. But anybody who's in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, and they want to be an appellate judge, they're tired of the day-to-day stuff of trials and motions and everything that a trial judge has to deal with. How could they do a sentence of probation? They would just shoot their career right out of the window, would they not?
Likely, yes. That sounds about right. Especially after what things like Lindsey Graham said, that if we were in charge of this, she wouldn't even get a hearing.
Yeah, I wish we played that clip because people are in denial about that. And in fact, we got a comment on YouTube about something similar about Larry. I'm paraphrasing, but why do you keep thinking back in 1996? You know, this is the present. And so since we're dealing with complaints tonight, the reason why I point out about 1996 is because we need to look backwards to move forward. As we look backwards, we will see the mistakes of what happened in the past, and it will help us to make better decisions going forward. And in fact, I intended to cue up a quote of President Ford making that very point. If we don't look backwards, we're prone to repeat the mistakes. So all the stuff that I complained about that happened in 1996 was the perfect storm coming together of the Republican takeover of Congress in 1994, having a very moderate to conservative Democratic president who was facing a re-election campaign against Senator Bob Dole, who had sponsored the legislation that we were pontificating about. You remember the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act? And I explained why.
I explained why
Dole, I believe he was the chief sponsor, and I explained why Clinton was not in a position to veto that. Well, if we recreate that same set of circumstances today, we're likely to get the same outcome we got in 1996, which would be a plethora of bad legislation that we got in 1996. That's why I dwell on the past, to help us not make the mistakes that we made as we go forward.
I have a quote that I've saved, and if you do the things that you will always done, then you will get the things you've always got. And I realize that that is pretty much trash for grammar, but it works.
It absolutely works, but I get so much criticism. They say, Larry, why do you always talk about the past? And I say, because I'm trying to prevent us from making the same mistakes in the future.
Very good, sir. Shall we move along?
Now, how many people are drinking right now? Because I did it.
I just told everyone to drink, so I don't know. No, I have no responses yet. Since we covered everything else, I wanted to discuss with you, Larry, that I participated in some phone calls this week for the local group, and we had one of our former guests on. We had Brandon Thomas, the attorney that's there in Atlanta, and he did a whole big spiel and then answered a whole bunch of questions. But one of the things that he said in his introduction about the people that he can help is that, depending on the kind of victim, more or less around the age of the victim that you do have, that he might not be able to help you. Even if you're a level one, even if everything else, he can choose to not take your case just because that's his prerogative. And B, I'm going to assume that this particular individual, because he was at the Atlanta conference in 2015, he's been doing this for a while and knows where he will and will not be effective and successful. And I'm assuming that attorneys would prefer to win, but I guess there are also attorneys that'll just be, say, here, pay my fee of $5,000 or whatever, and just take it and maybe do their best, but knowing that you're going to lose, and now they just pocketed $5,000. So then on another call, I heard an individual, and I'm not going to go into his name and call him out, but he said that he actually called Mr. Thomas and spoke to him, gave him some of the details of his case. And Mr. Thomas said, I'm sorry, I can't help you. And in my brain, I go, he just saved you $3,500. You should be happy. But he was like, well, he couldn't help me, so I don't like this guy. I wanted to get your feedback on this type of scenario.
Well, I'm amazed that a person would react that way. But I mean, we just talked about an amazing reaction a couple of times through this program, so maybe I shouldn't be amazed. But I hear this complaint my entire professional career about how there are no honest attorneys out there. Well, this attorney sounds like to me that he evaluated the likelihood of success on your case and felt like that the success odds were very low and couldn't in good conscience take your money and not be able to have a reasonable hope of winning the relief that you're seeking. You should be grateful that a person was straight with you and didn't take your $5,000, is the more typical the fee, is his only $3,500. That's really remarkably low. But yeah. it would be $5,000 or more in most instances, I would think. But if he's upset about that, then what I would encourage him to do is to continue talking to attorneys until he finally gets the one that tells him what he wants to hear, which is, I'll take your case and I'll take your money. But don't be surprised when you get turned down, because I'm assuming that Brandon has his reason. Now, I would like to have a high success rate. You're not going to have 100% success rate if you do enough of those petitions.
Of course.
There are going to be people who will be declined. You do everything you can to minimize that by doing your homework in advance. And I'm more persistent about what I would want to do if we had that process. I want to have my own evaluation in hand, because I want to be able to counter what the state says if they throw up roadblocks. Okay. But a lot of attorneys don't do that. They think it's overkill. But I want to make sure that I have the best odds of winning. I want to have a conversation with the prosecutor. I want to know what they're going to take as their position. I don't want to be surprised at court when they get in there and they start spewing out stuff that I had no idea they were going to say. So the best way for me to find that out is to have a cozy chat with the prosecutor and say, hey, I'm going to be filing this petition, contemplating filing. What's your office posture going to be? And I want to know that. And if you I don't appreciate an attorney who says, I've done these things in good conscience, I can't take your case, then I don't know what to say, because I would be grateful.
You actually just reminded me of another statement, someone that claims to be a paralegal, and I'm not evaluating whether he is. I'm just going to take him at his word that he has at least taken paralegal classes, if he's not a full paralegal. And he was encouraging people that when it's time for you to be eligible to file a petition to be removed, he's like, you can absolutely file it yourself. And I was like, ding, 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 ding. Maybe not the best of ideas. You want to speak to that one real quick?
Well, he's absolutely correct. You may do it yourself. You absolutely are entitled to do it yourself. You're absolutely entitled to represent yourself in this country. As far as I know, I can't think of any situation except for maybe a minor where you must have an attorney, but you're absolutely entitled to do that. I don't advise it, because as we've talked about before, you can't have the access as the petitioner that you would have as the petitioner's attorney. You can't have the frank conversation with your adversary that your attorney can't. You're not going to be able to sit down with the district attorney and say, what do you think of me? What's your argument going to be about me? What right. type of intelligence do you have on me? They're going to say...
What is he going to say, though? I mean, I know that you're allowed to do it. And so when you call the DA and ask that, is he just going to say... have a nice day? Or is he going to him and haw? Are they going to give you bunk information?
Well, if you were to succeed in getting through, they'll tell you that they'll do their speaking in the court, and that they will announce their position to the court. That's what they'll tell you.
Do you not have any sort of recourse to then say that ask the judge, saying, I'm trying to do this, I don't have the money, or I'm competent to do it? I mean, you're competent to do it yourself. And the DA will not talk to me, and I cannot adequately prepare for my case.
You don't have that right as a petitioner for relief. There's nothing in the statute. We've read it. Is there anything that says the DA shall disclose any information? They have to disclose it at the hearing, but they don't have to disclose it pre-hearing.
I see. But, I mean, that's not disclosure. I mean, I guess that's part of a criminal case. So this is civil. Is that right?
This is a civil case within a criminal posture. Yeah, they use that criminal case number, but this is a civil proceeding, so to speak. And they're not gonna. I mean, go ahead and try it. And if it works, we'll give you kudos on the podcast. We'll have you on here, and we'll let you explain to the world how you did it and how wonderful it was. But from 20 years of experience in the legal system, it's very unusual for a prosecutor to talk to a defendant. And you're not a defendant per se, but this is a quasi-criminal proceeding related to your criminal conviction. It's going to be styled as State of Georgia versus, I bet if you look at your own, I bet that's what you'll how the petition was set up. That's how the order is set up. But you look at that, they're just not going to talk to you until you get to court. And then you're blindsided.
Right. I got you on that. No, I totally got you on that part of it. Gosh, so even you, with all of the knowledge that you have of how the system works and all that stuff, and perhaps you have a relationship with the DA, but you can't go into the DA, even yourself, and go, hey, I'm going to file this thing about me, and what do you have on me? And he's going to say, kick rocks?
I would never even contemplate doing it myself. I absolutely wouldn't. It's like, I know the conversation that needs to be had, and it's not going to be had. How many people are willing to hear that? When they tell them, actually, we hate your guts. You have been a nuisance to this town for 20 years. You got off too lightly, and we would like to see you suffer, and we're going to do everything we can to keep you on the registry. You're not going to tell the person that. You'll tell their attorney that. You probably wouldn't be that blunt, but you'd say, no, we're not going to be able to work with you on this one. You know, this one's a sensitive case for our office, and we're going to have to fight you tooth and nail. Well, have you got any information? Have you got any information on my client? Yeah, we do. In fact, you know, we've gotten reports over the years. He's been doing this. He's been doing that. And we're gonna raise those when this hearing is called. We're gonna raise these reports.
Did I ever tell you a story about me going into court that my attorney sent me on a dummy mission?
Yes, you told me that, and it did not end well.
So I had a motion. This was a sentence modification so that I could see my kid, because that's one of the probation restrictions, is that you can't. And just for any listeners that haven't heard this story, my attorney hands me the paperwork to sign the order from the judge and sends me down to the courthouse, and I get in, and I, like, knock on the door. Who are you? I said, I'm here to have the judge sign something. They press the button. They open the door. Like, they let me in, Larry. And I go down the hallway, and I go sit in the office, and his secretary is there, and I hand her the order, and she looks at it for a second, and, like, over the tops of her glasses, if you're looking at the YouTube video, she looks at me. She goes, is this you? And I said, yes, ma'am. And I mean, I was dressed up like in khakis and a polo. I mean, I wasn't looking like a slouch off the street. And then next thing I know, she says, one moment, please. And I mean, I don't know what's coming, but next thing I know, a bunch of big burly people come and meet me in the judge's office, and they surround me like, what are you doing in there? I'm like, I was getting something signed. But I don't know if this would be remotely similar to trying to deal with the DA and represent yourself, but this was a terrible idea. Terrible, terrible, terrible.
And it's even more terrible that your attorney didn't tell you that, because what the process would look like, at least in the era that that happened, it may have changed after COVID, but what it would look like is normally they used to have boxes for orders to be left to be signed. And if they need to be expedited, the runner would ask for access to the judge's office if the judge wasn't on the bench. And then they would go sit in the judge's outer office and wait for the judge to sign the order. But you'd present yourself as the runner, and they generally know who the runners are for the firms who have runners, because they see them regularly. So you would not have been recognized as a usual runner. And no. So your attorney did not tell you that this is going to happen. See, I would have told you, hey, you know, when you go in there, they're not going to recognize you as a runner. And so they're going to be curious as to who you are. But oftentimes, if it's not urgent, and you probably wanted that order yesterday, so you weren't going to wait for them to leave it in a box and pick it up once it was signed and file it with the clerk. You wanted it now, correct?
I needed it that day. I was flying out the next right. day to go visit for Thanksgiving.
Yeah, so you wanted the order post haste, as they call it, and you did not yes. have time to wait. And therefore, you took... So the attorney should have told you, well, the only way you can get this order is if you take it to the judge's office and wait. But I do not recommend that for you, because you are the defendant and this may not go well for you, but you do have the right to do it. But if they recognize you as a defendant, it's not going to go well for you. If they'd have told you that, would you have still done it?
Given the circumstances, I might have been, I guess the expression these days would be YOLO. I may have done that and just gone for it and be damned the consequences. I ended up having like the sergeant of arms, whatever his title would be, like the courthouse police, like he himself took it up there and had it signed for me, because they were like, sorry dude, my bad. But like, okay, yeah, well, anyway, then, I walked out of there with it.
Well, then you would have taken it to the clerk to file it in, so it'd be valid. So you would have taken it to the clerks to be
correct
to be
I believe that's how that went.
So yeah, that's the way it works. And then once you had a filed or a copy of a filed order, then you're good to go.
Well, Larry, sir, I believe that we have come to the conclusion of our program for the evening. Do you have any parting words?
Yes, I do. Everyone needs,
please share them.
Everyone needs to be aware that we have this vast arsenal of information on the FYP Education website. What is that? FYPeducation.org, right?
That is correct, fypeducation.org.
And you are free to download transcripts. There's an amazing search capability on that website, right? That you have that same search function there where you can look for keywords and find out what we've talked about.
Correct.
And we received a,
yes.
a request for something from an inmate in Georgia. We just received it a couple of days ago. He wants to know about proximity restrictions. So I had our administrative assistant do the search for the most recent time proximity restrictions popped up, and it was on episode 217. So he's receiving a complimentary copy of episode 217 simply because he wrote to us. And you can do the same thing for people who have questions that you may not know the answer to. You could use that search and say, gee, they've talked about it. Now you're going to have to do a little bit of work, because it's going to bring up the word. It brought up several episodes where we talked about proximity and residency restrictions. But it's an amazing resource. It's free. And if you want those to be sent to us, to you from us, we can do that. We'll do one complimentary. After that, there'll have to be a fee associated with it, because we're spending research time and cost. But to show you what we can do for you at FYP Education, we will send one request per per person. So,
fair enough. The only other thing that I will say, Larry, is I don't know if I have this worded correctly, but I will say, and this pretty much excludes you from this expression, but the reason why we are here today with the registry that we have is because the people before us either weren't willing or weren't successful at making things better for us. And I think that it is fairly common that when people do finish with their obligation to the registry, that they skip town, you never hear them from again, the earth spins too fast, they fall off. I'm not doing that. And so I am still here with Registry Matters. I'm still here for FYP. I'm still here to do the podcast. I'm still here to do all the advocacy work that I do for everyone else around the country as well. I'm still here, even though I don't have an obligation anymore. So FYP.
Well, you know it's sinister. It's that greed you have for this vast amount of money that's coming in. And it's all motivated by selfish capitalist greed. You just go ahead and admit that. That's what's causing it.
I will. Okay, I'll own that one. That's totally what it is.
So, I mean, we're bringing in at least $10,000-$15,000 a week, and that's what's really motivating you.
You are totally correct. I need to talk for just 1 second, because we had a patron that, Josh, I want to say thank you, Josh. Josh increased his Patreon so that he could get a transcript, and you should have received that, and your vast array of staffing over there at the FYP Education Headquarters.
We did, and he will start with this particular episode, and again, we can send back episodes. You can do it as a listener. You can go find something. They're all there PDF'd beautifully to be printed. But if you want us to do it, then there are, unfortunately, capitalism has a cost, and we will have to assess a fee for doing that. But they're there totally free.
Very good. So last week on Who's That Speaker, I played this very funny one.
Yeah, I tell you, schools are a very appetizing opportunity. I just saw a nice piece in The Lancet arguing that the opening of schools may only cost us 2-3% in terms of total mortality. And, you know, that's any life is a life lost. But to get every child back into a school where they're safely being educated, being fed, and making the most out of their lives with a theoretical risk on the backside, it might be a trade-off some folks would consider.
Do you know who that is, Larry?
I do not.
That is Dr. Oz, who is a junk doctor. He peddles all kinds of pseudoscience crap. And he is running for senator, and I believe he's endorsed by Trump. And he's running for state senator in, federal senator in Pennsylvania.
Well, he'll probably win. Go ahead.
Oh, God. That terrifies me, Larry. Terrifies me. But I found that comment. I was just looking around for stuff and thought that was really funny, because he's making the argument of that 3%. And I think we should accept some sort of 3% mortality. Like, seriously, can you imagine 3%? What do you think the population, children, school age, 100 million? So 3%, 3 million, some rough number of 3 million kids dropping dead every year to COVID. Like, anyone is going to go for that as being okay?
Well, it's kind of absurd, but I'm going to bring in a clip.
But the other part of that, but if it saves just one, Larry, if it just saves one, we can squash on everybody's civil liberties, right?
Well, I don't think I've bought into that, but others have.
Yes, I understand. So anyway, that was Dr. Oz, and I got some kind of cryptic answers from people. More people than I expected got it, but someone on YouTube, and Salvatore is the one that got it and wrote it over on YouTube. Please email me so that I can find them easier. And that was... So registrymatterscast@gmail.com is who that will be. I suspect most people are going to get this one. No clues. Nothing at all. Here you go. Here is for episode 223. Email me at registrymatterscast@gmail.com if you know who this one is.
I want every child in this state to feel seen, heard, and supported, not marginalized and targeted because they are not straight, white, and Christian.
Do you know who that is?
I don't know the name, but I heard it, and I know the context. Okay. So
that is an incredibly powerful thing that's going around right now. So if you know who that is, feel free to email me at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And that will shut down the show, Larry. You didn't have it. You said there was a snail mail request person. Do you have the name of the person? I assume not.
No, I don't. But I did want to say about the senator, the senator thing. There's a campaign in the state of Georgia between Herschel Walker,
correct,
and Raphael Warnock. And I've got one from Walker saying he's trying to be intelligent about critical race theory, which I don't understand. So please don't ask me to explain it. I don't understand it. But he called it CTR. He said, and I'm going to tell you about this CTR.
Okay. Well, now you've just told everyone what we're going to actually end up with for next week's Who's That Speaker?
So, CTR.
Yeah, critical race theory. Because the United States doesn't have a checkered past of doing horrible things to everyone other than pretty much white people. So if you say anything negative about white people, then you are being critical. Therefore, you can't speak about it.
So
that's, I think that's in a nutshell what it is, in my opinion.
I'm glad you explained it because I don't understand it.
You can find all the show notes over at registrymatters.co and fypeducation.org. You can leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. Email again is registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And then, of course, over at patreon.com/registrymatters if you would like to support the program, listen in live, and those kind of perks. Find us everywhere on social media at Registry Matters. And I think that is all I have, sir. And I hope you have a fantastic rest of your weekend. And I will talk to you soon.
And thank you, everyone. And look forward to next week. There's a very special guest coming in here.
Beautiful. Fantastic. Take care, Larry. Have a good night. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to FYP.